Hello and welcome. You are listening to Celebrating the Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. We are joined by...
Hey, it's Hugo.
Hey, it's Tom.
Hey, it's Kiriko.
Hey, it's Elliot.
Hey, hi, Elliot.
Hello. That's the good news.
It's the Fantastic Four back in the house. The return of the Mac.
The return of the Mac.
Yeah, baby.
The bad news is cinemas are closed. We're feeling a bit of cinema blues, shall we say?
Yeah, they're not entirely closed, but also not entirely open. Let's keep it at that.
That's even worse.
So we've decided to sort of come up with our cinema comforts coming into the Christmas season. What do we watch when we're alone that comforts us?
Yeah.
We haven't got a cold open, actually, because we're making things comfortable for ourselves.
Yeah, we're so comfortable.
Deadlines are really not comfortable at all.
Too lazy to care.
But wait, the question is, what do you watch when you're alone and you'd like to be comfortable?
Well, sort of hooking it up to last week's episode about guilty pleasures and our confessional corner, as you weren't there, maybe you could tell us what your guilty pleasure comfort food is.
I have many.
Take your time.
Did you take a lot of time defining the definition of guilty pleasure? And
Yeah, I read out the definition, the Wikipedia definition of it, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't feel guilty about anything, to be honest.
That was
damn right. You basically summed up our podcast.
Okay, great.
Yeah, man, it took us an hour.
Yes, did that once again. Okay, so I can name a couple of films which... I'm going to start here. I got my wisdom teeth pulled out a couple of days ago. So that means that I'm not in a lot of pain because I'm going to do some ASMR.
Nice.
This is the packaging of my painkillers. I'm
it's
doing
very
fine.
Comforting.
It was very comfortable.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty comfortable right now. I have been for the past couple of days. And I watched a number of films which I watch repeatedly when I'm sick or when I'm alone. And I guess that's the comfort thing that we're looking for.
Yeah, it's kind of like the chicken soup allegory, right?
Yeah, that one. My chicken soup is Hustlers, the stripper film.
Oh, with Jennifer Lopez.
J-Lo, which is an amazing film.
I just want to take care of my grandma, maybe go shopping every once in a while.
When I was a kid, I always wanted to work with animals. I was close. These Wall Street guys. You see what they did to this country? They stole from everybody. Hardworking people lost everything. And not one of these douchebags went to jail. The game is rigged, and it does not reward people who play by the rules. But it's like robbing a bank, except you get the keys.
And no guilt at all. Another chicken soup film of mine would be Marie Antoinette.
Wow. Her chicken soup films are bangers.
Yeah.
It's just like hot, lonely girls with a lot of money. Yes. No, I'm thinking of it. Yeah. That's my comfort. And I'm thinking, is there guilt in looking at rich women? No. Just pleasure.
Yeah.
What about you, Hugo?
You know, it is pretty nice to see rich women depicted on screen, especially if they, you know, find the means to get that money themselves. There's something oddly liberating about Hustlers.
Marie Antoinette did not.
No,
get that money.
That's where, like, I was thinking about Hustlers. Marie Antoinette, however, is, you know, ultimately also a very depressing film if you think about it long and hard. But if in the process of watching it, it's actually kind of fine. And the thing that I've been kind of enthralled by in the last weeks, maybe share some of these qualities. I've been totally immersed in the Beatles again by, you know, it's the most cliche thing to do right now, watching the Peter Jackson trilogy documentary series Get Back.
We're talking about 14 songs we hope to get. I've got a feeling.
How many have we already recorded good enough?
No.
None of us has had the idea of what the show's going to be. I've got a
feeling. I would dig to play on stage, you know. Nobody else wants to do a show.
I think we've got a bit shy. Oh, no!
Yeah! Yeah! In which the Beatles are recording the Let It Be album in approximately 1 month, talking about deadlines and how not comforting they are. But there's something oddly soothing about seeing people at like the height kind of their power, figuring out this creative process that brought them all together once, but was slowly also, you know, pushing all of them away. They came together. They got back. They got together. Back. Yes, they came together. They got back. And they let it be, you know. They made the album.
Kind of like this coming together this evening.
I mean,
I imagine
feel,
that.
And this is my, I've guessed, ultimately the most comforting thing. Like, I could literally talk about this podcast, or like this podcast as well, about this series for hours. But there's something oddly soothing about just mirroring yourself to what the Beatles are doing in that documentary, because they're uniquely like individual entities within that group, and they have all each other's like own dynamics, and then they literally just, you know, like create some of the most mind-blowing tunes out of thin air, and suddenly they are there, which is very pleasing to look at, and it gives you this kind of courage or power, like it instills this kind of idea that you in fact also have the power to create things, which is funny because I was watching it in a moment where I was like literally really tired from a new COVID measurement where you know all the work that you're doing in and around the cinema is kind of for nothing because there's less films playing. So I was like, oh yes, this is what creativity means, and that was very, very comforting. Yeah,
are you likening us to the Beatles?
Yeah, well, maybe, you know. I do think that the series kind of invites you to see when you are Paul McCartney, who's kind of like the leading driving creative force of the Beatles at that moment, for sure, or who's at that moment John Lennon, who's kind of like more extremely talented jester that just knows how to play the songs but wants to derail all of them all the time. And then you have Ringo, who just does everything very well, but doesn't really do that much besides that, which is
Beatles
great. You know,
is so chicken soup.
Yeah, Beatles is like very chicken soup. And then you have George, who's like the really interesting dissenting person who sometimes totally, you know, aligns with everybody, and then the other times totally clashes out of it. Yeah, it is chicken soup. Now I'm also listening to all the Beatles albums again. I'm like totally Beatles pilled. Yeah. It's awful because it feels like I'm like 11 again, you know, just listening to all that stuff, being totally obsessed about it. But it's great, you know.
You were obsessed with the Beatles when you were 11?
Totally, man, yeah. Like, that was the biggest thing in my life, you know. It was so crazy. Yeah. Wow. Just listening to all these tunes, they blew me away. I'm getting back to all those, hey.
Oh, boy.
To all those tunes, and every time I'm listening to them, I'm like, Jesus, how the hell, you know, they're actually really good. It's nice. Kind of corny to like the Beatles, but also not, which is why it's maybe the perfect guilty pleasure in a sense.
Oh, man. People who say that Beatles are corny have no idea what they're listening to.
Yeah, that's
I've already
the thing.
Always really, really hated like, people who said like it's okay, it is comfortable music, but it's bizarrely genius.
Yeah. This is the thing. And also, yeah, like imagine making, this is a good exercise actually, imagine making in an 8-hour series where it's kind of just cinema vérité, right? The camera is just looking at these guys and there's like microphones everywhere so you can hear everything that they're discussing with each other. Imagine any other kind, almost like group that could fill 8 hours of that and you are totally enthralled by it. Like,
yeah, because it also maybe it demystifies them and sort of
reinforces
it at the same time.
Yeah.
And the irony is it sounds corny because it's influenced everything. Well, a lot of
yeah,
come
I guess
after,
so.
And
too.
People perhaps don't.
Yeah, but still,
where.
Man, if you like, is it Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band that ends with the dog whistle, with like the tone that nobody can hear except for dogs, and then when the record came out, all the dogs started barking on the streets. Like, I mean, that's the sound, that's a legend, you know? That's,
yeah, no, they're like they're really awesome.
Yeah.
And this is why this film is also, you know, really nice, is that at this moment in their lives, they've done all that crazy stuff. They've done all the psychedelia. Mm. They've done all the overdubbing in the studio with all these advanced techniques. And now it's just literally them back together making a record in the old style, you know, just them with
that breaks them up eventually.
Yeah.
Spoiler.
But The cool thing is that, you know, you have the Let It Be film from the 1970s, which kind of, it uses the same material, but it's a two-hour film that really implies that this is the really the driving moment where the Beatles just fall apart, and it's because of creative difference this, and Yoko Ono that. And this film just totally opens up the scope and shows that actually this was really their last hooray, and it wasn't as, you know, combative.
Or cynical.
Yeah. It was not a cold war in the studio. It was them literally just hanging out. So it's basically a hangout movie, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, so, yeah. I mean, hangout movies, that's perfect comfort.
Absolutely.
Comfortable.
What's your hangout movie?
What's my hangout movie? I don't know. Merging it with the whole Christmas and holiday thing, I started thinking about movies that I watch literally every year. And the one that is maybe a bit ironic is Groundhog Day.
Do you watch it on the Groundhog Day?
No. Well, actually, we usually screen it on the Groundhog Day. Oh, yeah. And then every year.
It's Groundhog Day!
Groundhog time.
1,000 people freezing their butts off waiting to worship a rat.
Weatherman Phil Connors is spending the day in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania.
Phil! Ned Ryerson, I did the whistling belly button trick at the high school talent show.
Bing!
Bing!
But Phil's about to find out he's not just stuck in Punxsutawney.
Will you be checking out today, Mr. Connors?
Chance of departure today, 100%.
He's stuck
in
Groundhog Day.
I'm reliving the same day over and over.
Phil!
Ned Ryerson?
Bing!
Do you ever have deja vu, Mrs. Lancaster?
I don't think so, but I could check with the kitchen.
Well, it's Groundhog Day. Again?
I usually watch it at home because it's a very nice cautionary tale for how not to become a dick. That's pretty much what the film is about. I mean, Bill Murray is a weatherman, and he's an extreme douche that, of course, like everybody knows, ends up in the same day over and over and over and over and over and over again.
Do you watch this every year to remind yourself not to fall into the same pitfalls?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, very much so. Yeah, actually, yeah, I think so. And that even if, I'm going to say this, like the last time I watched it, I realized that the whole, so he falls in love with his Andy McDowell, his intern, I'm not sure, or maybe she's just came to work at the weather station or the news station.
There's a power dynamic there.
There's a certain power dynamic there, yeah. Like the way he tries to seduce her, which she, of course, forgets because it's the same day over and over again,
yeah.
is so extremely problematic. And funny at the same time. I will say that. But yeah, maybe that's my... It's not really a hangout movie at all.
It's very comfortable for sure.
Yeah, it is very comfortable for sure. Yeah, because and you know it from seeing it over and over again.
Is that the primary... Well, no, because that the Beatles doesn't do that for you, even though you know how the story's going to end. But is comfort also about knowing what you're going to expect?
I guess so. I mean, I think like the glove you've put on every year... And you put it on again and it still fits.
The glove doesn't fit.
Yeah. If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Yeah. Like what you were saying, Kiko, with the Beatles, I think that one of the charms of that film is that you know all the songs, right? Because everybody knows the Beatles songs, I guess. And then you hear them being played out and you see them being played out and they're not quite the songs. But then eventually, slowly, they take up the shape of the thing that you know. And then... To get back to Tom's ham-fisted metaphor, suddenly, you know, the glove is starting to fit and everything falls into place. And that's a profoundly pleasing thing to see and hear. So there's something about that, maybe about expectations being met in comfort as well. Mm. That, you know, you expect the thing to give you a certain feel because you have known how to give yourself that feel through that thing. And then it delivers. And that's where the comfort comes in, maybe.
Maybe it's also a reoccurring characteristic of these films is that there's just enough happening for something not to really be happening that you know what to expect, but then the expectation also ends up in no action, which is quite nice if you're, you know,
this
laying
is exactly
down and by
why
yourself.
I like Groundhog Day as that film for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's 100% that.
In its essence, almost that.
About everything that happens is not really changing anything all the time. Yeah.
The first thing I always have to think about is the scene where he's watching Jeopardy and talking along with it.
This country's largest lake, Chapala, is located near the city of Guadalajara.
What is Mexico?
Leslie.
What is Mexico?
Correct.
Lakes and rivers 400.
Seneca is the largest of these lakes in west central New York.
What are the Finger Lakes?
Jim.
What are the Finger Lakes?
Correct.
Lakes and rivers for 600.
This South American lake drains into the smaller lake.
What is Titicaca?
In Bolivia. Jim.
What is Titicaca?
Correct.
Lakes and rivers for 1,000.
Milky colored from glacial clay when entering Lake Geneva, this river is clear blue upon exiting. Jim?
What is the Rhone?
The Rhone. Good for $1,000. You are $500 off the lead right now.
I always quote along to that because I know what's happening.
You have become Bill Murray. How about you, Elliot? What are you watching in the wintry season?
So the film I always watch is It's a Wonderful Life, a classic Christmas film. And again, it's probably similar, not similar to, yeah, similar to Groundhog Day in the sense it's someone taking a look at their life and realizing what they're becoming and taking action. So I always find that comforting. And then sort of similar to the Beatles documentary, I recently watched Tick, Tick, Boom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's by...
It's Garfield, right?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Not the cat, but the actor.
They both like lasagna.
But it's by my favorite man, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yeah,
Lin-Manuel Miranda man! Yay! He's back.
I can say it's better than In the Heights.
In the Heights.
That was a big disappointment. We never got to speak about that. But it sort of lends itself back to finding comfort in a struggling artist and seeing them sort of go through all the things that you perhaps experience and then them coming out the other end. And so, that's probably quite comforting to me. And I love musical numbers.
And yeah, this is the moment where like everybody's going back to the Stephen Sondheim again as well.
Yeah.
That's like also in Tick, Tick, Boom. He's like the main character. He's very much, you know, touched by this moment that he met Sondheim, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I recently saw the new version of West Side Story by Spielberg.
This is my first time in New York City. I want to be happy here. I want to make a life, a home.
Are you ready?
Tonight is about family. The first gringo boy who smiles at you.
I never seen you before. You're not Puerto Rican.
Is that okay?
Do you want to start World War III?
You know, I wake up to everything I know either getting sold or wrecked or being taken over by people that I don't like.
You keep away from him as long as you're in my house.
I'm a grown-up now, Bernardo. I'm gonna think for myself.
Tony, we need you if we're going to war.
You know, has to deal with all these iconic songs written by Sondheim and on the music of Bernstein. And that was a very, how do you say it? It's not necessarily a comforting watch. I'm not sure what your take is on the original West Side Story, but that's a pretty scary film as well. You know, the way that the film deals with racism and it's like ferociously sometimes pro-white in a sense sometimes. It's kind of scary, actually. The new one seems very aware that that is scary and then knows how to address that, which is pretty impressive, I would say. So it's not truly a comforting film. Also, it's really big tragedy. But there are some moments that just, you know, connect when you hear those old songs, but they're done by Spielberg. Suddenly everything comes together. And I know that we did an episode on remakes earlier, but this is, you know, maybe one of those few remakes that's actually... really profoundly add something to an original. Oh, Spielberg is a boss, man. He's like, I recently saw a photo of him on Twitter on the set of West Side Story together with Spike Lee.
Spike Lee, yeah.
And he has like a big stogie cigar between his fingers, and he has like his ring finger like shoved in his like denim pocket, and he's got like a Hawaii shirt on. And the dude is dripping hard, man. Spielberg, you know, is fucking dripping. I was very impressed by how effortlessly cool he still seems to be, which is very impressive, you know.
I recently saw that documentary about him called Spielberg, which is about him. Nobody has anything bad to say about him, so he probably produced it, but it's an amazing documentary to see how that guy works, man. Like, bizarre. It shows you all the films that, all those films that he made. Like, he's just a master of making things work.
Yeah. Yeah, also, this new West Side Story is like incredibly meticulous and, you know, really knows how to reference the old film without trying to pretend to make the old film again, which is a big, you know, thing to do with such a classic source material. And he really, I think, often upstages the original. It's just a different kind of film as well. The original has this kind of like technicolor, phantasmagorical nature to it. Everything is kind of like a dream. Here, much more is grounded in a kind of heightened realism, and he manages to pull it off so effortlessly, almost. It's like watching professional tennis.
Maybe we could look at it a bit differently in terms of comfort. So two films that also stick out to me when I'm sort of looking to be comforted when watching a film would be, say, Lost in Translation or Her. And for me, I just find something comforting seeing someone feel so lost in a metropolis. And I don't know how you feel, whether you share that same feeling, or why perhaps we find it comforting in those situations.
Well, I think already with all the films that we've named thus far, there is like a huge sense of self-identification with totally, the films we like to watch, just to enhance the feeling that you're either lacking or want to get in touch with more.
So how does Hustlers and...
Honey, what a simple question. Let me explain to you. Everything about all the girls in Hustlers is all I aspire to be in life. It's just the funny slut fantasy of every young slut that wants to be a stripper embodied with, I don't know, I like, that's also Marie Antoinette, I guess. I just like shimmer and glitter, and it does something very profound to my heart.
So it's both either kind of like a power fantasy, or it is the film showing you it's okay if you're not totally in control all the time. So it's kind of like a pat on the back, and it's kind of like a push forward, like maybe somewhere a comfort film is in between those two modes.
Yeah, and it's, I think, also understanding about yourself what your own problems are, that your attraction can at the same time also be your problem, which in my case would be the diamonds in Hustlers, and in your case
yeah, that's a good question. What would be the problem in my comfort films?
Well, maybe another question. What is, because you're now watching the Beatles documentary, but do you have a film that you repeatedly watch when you're sick, or maybe the film that you've watched the most in your life?
Yeah, I used to have those, and now I don't really have them anymore, but I used to, and whenever I had a cold, when I was at home with the flu as a kid, I would just watch The Lord of the Rings. So that's Peter Jackson again. That kind of checks out.
I wish none of this had happened.
So do all who live to see such times. But that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to us. There are other forces at work in this world, Frodo, besides the will of evil. Bilbo was meant to find the ring, in which case you also were meant to have it. And that is an encouraging thought.
Now I don't really have that, but I do have a really rich tradition on the 1st of January, just only watching films all day, but they're all mostly new films, I guess.
That's fun.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's a great way to start the year. And once
you do that alone?
No, like sometimes alone, sometimes with my girlfriend. Like now that I live with my girlfriend, we do it together. But I've seen, 1 year I saw Damnation by Bela Tarr, and I saw Mean Girls, and I saw that that Scream Life horror film Unfriended. And it's just like the nonsense mix of films, but that's good. They don't need to be coherent, right? It's just like you're tired, you just want to see a bunch of movies. I don't really have that, but lately, because of the lockdown maybe, and because it becoming Christmassy, I have a deep desire to watch School of Rock again.
Oh, wow.
I used to watch that film a lot when I was a kid. And that's a film I think that never gets old.
I think this is the first time someone's mentioned something about nostalgia, which is interesting because no one sort of...
We never really talk about that.
First time ever in a podcast to talk about nostalgia.
This could be an interesting idea to explore. In
My point was more that we speak a lot about nostalgia, and yet it's not the first thing that we go to when we think about comfort.
Yeah.
No, that's true, actually. Like, because... Oh, yeah. Good point, Elliot. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah. Jesus.
Yeah, because the movie that I want to talk about is also completely not a nostalgia movie, actually. Which is, it's A Serious Man by the Coen brothers.
X squared, so that delta X equals the square root of 0.077 a squared minus zero, from which we derive the square root of 0.077 a squared. And also, the uncertainty in P is equal to the square root of bracket P squared minus bracket P squared, which also equals the square root of H over A squared, which lets us delta X, delta P equals the square root of 0.077 A squared, H over A squared, and 1.74 H bar, okay? The uncertainty principle. It proves we can't ever really know what's going on.
It's the same identification thingy going on because that movie fits like a glove for me, but it's all about not understanding life and having to deal with the fact that you should give up to try to understand life. Yeah, it's my favorite Coen brothers because that's the movie where the Coen brothers go so deep into the concept that they always do. All their films are about a narrative that doesn't really exist, or they don't have a narrative. So at the end of The Big Lebowski, nothing really has happened. At the end of Fargo, some people die. What was it all for? Nothing. But A Serious Man does this wonderful thing where it's not only a movie that ends up nowhere, but the entire film is about a guy questioning life itself and getting no answers. So it doubles down on that sort of weird thing that the Coen brothers do, and I really like that.
And I also think that in relation to what Elliot said about, you know, nostalgia being maybe closely linked to these kind of films, the nostalgia that we have talked about in at length, of course, is this kind of like sickly desire to transpose the qualities of the films that we're now describing to a film that maybe is of the same IP or the same franchise or has a set of expectations already that the film needs to meet because a prior, you know, media object like a film or a series or a toy or a book or whatever needs to meet those. So it becomes this kind of like perverted relationship with the qualities that you like of the original. Whereas going back to the original time and time again, like a popular song on the radio or a thing that you would have on your old MP3 player or just on your old CDs or whatever, it's just that you become so intimately familiar with the object itself that you become so enthralled by the little gaps that you are like in, Groundhog Day, predicting, you know. You just know in a piece of music when the drum fill is coming in and you are anticipating already like everything 20 seconds or everything happening 20 seconds further on in the song. And then it comes and that gives you the pleasure, you know. That's what happens when you listen to a song time and time again. And I guess maybe in film it's kind of the same. Whereas then maybe the big difference is that films or maybe songs as well are very ambiguous things and they do change with you. Maybe the Elliot that watched Lost in Translation for the first time is not the same Elliot he is now, you know. And maybe that also changed the film and that could be a very gratifying experience as well. I'm not sure. Maybe it's a question in what way you've maybe sometimes also grown with the film or have gained new perspective on the film because of your personal growth.
I would like you to answer that, Tom, maybe, seeing you watch Groundhog Day every year.
Oh, no,
how have you grown along with
Canuck? I actually wanted to flip it around. Said, like, there can also be situations where you and the movie haven't changed, but the world has changed. Yes. Because I have that with Marie Antoinette. I remember seeing Marie Antoinette and I loved it. And then Reviews came out and my friends saw it and everybody hated it. I was like, did I see a different film?
Like that Simpsons meme. And am I wrong? No, it's the kids that are
wrong. I was like, huh? But I like that. So, and then years passed and now everybody loves Marie Antoinette. You know, I think that people didn't get the sort of shallowness, because there's a lot of shallowness in Marie Antoinette, which is there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
So people didn't want it to be fun or something. And then it was fun and it was about nothing. Wasn't that really the point?
Most people are just seriously ill-equipped with dealing with Sofia Coppola's films because maybe. They are about those qualities maybe as well. What do you think?
So how did... Wait, but you think the world changed or your friends changed?
Oh, the world changed. Okay. My friends are in the world. My friends do actually exist. I'd like to stipulate that on the podcast.
And they're not Bill Murray, nor the Groundhog.
That's how the world changed. His imaginary friends didn't like it. Okay. Real friends.
I have one friend.
Yeah,
you don't know what he's called, right?
I fully agree with you.
Oh, Michael Caine. Not a lot of people know that. Right?
Yeah, I think the world has a very complicated relationship with Sofia Coppola. And I think it's the same quality that I see in Hustlers that I also see in Sofia Coppola movies,
yeah,
but
totally.
on a much more subtle way, is that, like, Sofia Coppola understands in a very profound way how to love and hate her own life so much at the same time, which I find so charming about what she does. And also to find glamour and shimmer and color and love for your trauma is something that not a lot of people can do in the same way that she does. I have another question for you guys, because we also spoke about the comfort of watching a film by yourself. Do you guys make any difference in certain films that you prefer to watch alone or rather watch in company?
Well, yeah, sometimes it is really awful when you show a film to people that you really, really like, and then you're mostly just watching people's reactions to the film, and they're all like just stoically watching or like being very bored or like
taking this in for Hugo,
trying to go to the phone. Yeah, like, oof, that's a tough set for Hugo. Do you ever have that experience?
All the time.
That's very uncomfortable. Like, shut up and now watch this film with me. It's the best thing ever happened. And then they're like, oh my God.
Yeah. I was so, so here in Lob, you screened La Haine for a couple of months. And I really wanted, like, a couple of friends who had never seen it and who are not necessarily into cinema to see that film. So I organized an event where I invited all these friends to go to the same screening at the same time. So it was like, it ended up maybe being four of us and I invited eight people, but that's fine. But I was so nervous for that moment. Because my expectations were so high. And then I thought that I had learned from that moment. I mean, they loved the film, but in the end, it didn't mean as much to them as it does for me. And I thought I learned from that moment to sort of let go of that idea that I want to create a shared world where all the things that I find beautiful, my loved ones find beautiful as well. But that did not happen. And I still have this, it's quite obsessive how I want, for example, my boyfriend to have seen all my favorite films, to a point where now I kind of feel bad for him almost, because
you're forcing it on.
I guess. Yeah.
I remember, like, have film critic friends from abroad, and we
film critic friends
from a different country, and we see each other on film festivals. And I talk about Miami Vice all the time. They are the same as you, but they're abroad, okay? And I remember that we had a moment. We had a moment where we finally watched, like, simultaneously Miami Vice, and I I've seen that film so often, I took an edible with it because I was really down to vibe with it. But then the edible kicked in and I became really conscious about if they were going to like the film or not. And I just had like most of the film, I had kind of a bad time because I just felt very responsible for the film. And then afterwards, they also didn't like it and they wanted to call me about the film to say that they didn't like it. And I just said, I'm sorry, I am too high for this. I love this film a lot. We can't talk about it now. And then I went to bed.
Wow. This, for some reason, this reminds me, I have a group of friends that I usually go to new films with. And now it's become harder because some of them have kids, but usually we can find a date and then we can all go. And it's, I think it's like six of us. And not everybody is in the film business, but some are. And I'll never forget that we were sawing the new Blade Runner film, Blade Runner 2049. And I was locked between two friends who had completely different opinions that, due to me seeing so many films with them, I could literally feel through the seats.
Yeah.
So I could feel the sigh on one side, like, oh, fuck. The Villeneuve guy is doing all
the Villeneuve.
Villeneuve. What a dick. What a dick. And on the other side, I could feel like the filmmaker next to me really liking it. Like, oh, yeah, of course. So, yeah, this is not about replicants. This is about replicants. Like, the oven. Yeah, it's nice. That I can see a film with that group, but it's better when we all have the same opinion. So I'll never forget.
In this case, you're not responsible.
No, not responsible at all. No. Although I remember that programmer of a cinema in Rotterdam, he organized a screening of Tenet for us. And well, he didn't really organize it for us, but he demanded that we see it there on 70mm. And then we saw it there together with the same group. So we went to Rotterdam, night train shit back, blah, blah, blah. And we all collectively hated it, but felt a bit ashamed for him. Like, so your cinema's reopened again, and here's a crew of some of your best friends telling you that this movie is complete tosh.
He didn't make the film, it's fine.
No, he didn't make the film, but he did feel like he...
And also, you're wrong, because Tenet is a great film.
Oh my God. No,
I listened to your
not...
smart blockbuster thing, and I had the urge to scream in my earphones about Villeneuve and Tenet, which brings up the question, by the way, what did you think of Dune? Sorry, I'm totally derailing, but
wow,
no comfort.
Dune,
yeah,
so hollow,
very comfortable watch.
No.
Like lovely
what?
Film, just pure vibes, no. Man. Just like
pure vibes,
yeah, just vibing, no. Man. Yeah, it was a great film. I loved
Stop.
That film. Yeah, that's
what
a vibey
you love
film.
About
man.
That film,
just the vibes, the desert, the desert power, the sand.
The desert power.
Listen to yourself.
You've
repeated yourself
power.
Three times.
We're gonna fucking throw you into a sandworm, boy.
Timothy Chalamet. He really wants to fuck his mom. The worms are huge. Jason Momoa is great.
Hold on. We're going to quote this back to you for years. Jason Momoa was great.
Yeah, he is a great actor, man. He's really lovely. I love him a lot. He's a great, you know, kind of himbo guy. He's very charismatic.
I agree with
But I love all the dump Villeneuve's. Sicario is his best film. I'm just going to put it on the record here. And
Sicario is a great film.
Yeah, it's a good dump film,
coming.
You know. Hmm? I wish you would disagree. That would have been funny.
Yeah, exactly. I knew it.
Yeah, no, that's a vibey film. That was comfort for me.
That was no vibes, man. The worms were great, I agree. But then for the rest of the film, it was a film that was trying so hard to be like funny. It's 3 points at the film. They made like maybe 2.5 jokes. And it were like 2.5 really bad jokes.
You have to piss in your costume. Yeah.
They,
don't remember that?
Maybe no. They don't really have a good sense of humor in Arrakis, you know.
They don't. But yeah. Then don't try to go there, you know. Keep it dry. Keep it deserty.
But it was super dry. This is where we insert the quote of Hayden Christensen saying he doesn't like sand.
I don't like sand. It's coarse and rough and irritating. And it gets everywhere.
I guess I just like the sand-based films, you know. I like my old I like
it's a very sandy film.
By the way, I put Old in my top 10, in my top 3 actually of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
let's see when they hang you.
When there's like a public trial.
You know what? There's going to be a moment where you're going to be punished. And the thing is that they're going to put you on an island where you age really quickly.
This is like Scrooge, you know, the three ghosts of cinema's past. They come to haunt me.
The ghosts of Christmas past.
Yeah.
I was in the Muppet's Christmas Carol.
Not all
actually, that's
know
a really
that.
Good movie to watch during Christmas. It's Muppet's Christmas Carol.
Yeah. So
I can't sing at all. I do sing in it.
With a thankful heart, with an endless joy, with a growing family, every girl and boy will be nephew and niece to me.
Nephew and niece to me.
Will bring love, hope and peace to me.
Love, hope and peace to me.
Yes, and every night will end, and every day will start, with a grateful prayer and a thankful heart.
So, Tom... Yeah, Tom, I'm like totally wondering, what are you screening during Christmas?
Well, it's funny that you asked that, Hugo.
Thank you.
So, last Corona Christmas, last Corona Christmas, I wanted to screen the movie that you don't like in this construct, I believe, Die Hard, the Christmas movie. That's a Christmas movie.
Yeah, I just have I have an opinion about this.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if we should say it on air, though.
Oh, wow.
Wait, you finally have an opinion that you won't want to share. That's amazing.
I can share it. I just, like, there's one specific retro film program in Amsterdam that, you know, made a big deal about having a really special Christmas film that is, like, you know, totally bonkers, and it's Die Hard.
And it's Die Hard, yeah.
And I'm like, that's on top of every, like, generic top 20 unexpected Christmas movies. One is Die Hard, and then on 3 or 4, whatever, is, like, Eyes Wide Shut. And then it's like, it's not a big deal if you call Die Hard a Christmas movie. Don't pretend like it is, you know? That's not interesting. Sorry, that's my... Like, Die Hard is a great film, but don't pretend that you are very special for thinking
it's true.
A Christmas film.
No, I'm... No, because I've screened Die Hard multiple times as a Christmas movie, and I never really talk about that. It's sort of, oh my God, alternative Christmas.
Yeah, everybody knows that, it's a Christmas movie.
Yeah, and I have the same thing with Eyes Wide Shut. I love that film, and I want to see it all the time.
You want to see Eyes Wide Shut all the time?
Yeah, oh man, movie so much.
That's a lovely film. That's a great
film.
That's
such a
talking about hangout film, man.
That's
some great
not chicken
that
soup. Come on.
Yeah, that's very much chicken soup for me. Oh my God, Kiriko, you 2001 every 5 years. And I have late stage Kubrick.
I have late stage
Kubrick. I should have a doctor look at that maybe someday. Sorry, sir. We have something to tell you. You have late stage Kubrick.
You are turning into AI, artificial intelligence.
Yeah. You are terminally Kubrick.
Napoleon complex.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, no. Eyes Wide Shut is such a wonderful film. Okay.
Nobody's disputing that. Are you screening this year?
Yeah. So last time that it didn't happen, I had It's Wonderful Life as one of them, because I never actually screened that before, because the film museum usually does that, and now they ended up not doing it. So I thought, like, hey, let's see if I can pick up, because I love Frank Capra, really.
Yeah.
That's talking about comfort films, like. It Happened One Night and It's a Wonderful Life are such not necessarily feel-good films, but there's something very special. It's very, very Christmassy about them, like in this old traditionalist American vibe, Christmas vibes. Vibey, just like Hugo would say, vibey films.
Like I would say about June.
Okay. From Sand to Snow. And the other ones this year would have been Paddington.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, just
yeah,
because
that's really nice.
Talk about vibey films.
Yeah.
Because we never really do things that are really new, like new Christmas movies, because there are a lot of shit new Christmas films, and I try to never really screen Love Actually. What are the other ones? Gremlins. That's always great. And that's just my sort of, that's my nostalgia movie.
Yeah, I love.
I think there's another one, but I can't remember.
Did you say the Arnold Schwarzenegger one? What was
Jingle
it?
All the Way.
Jingle yeah. All the Way. Almost Tempted.
It's a nice film. I like Arnold Schwarzenegger and his comedic roles.
And but maybe, what do you guys want to see?
Yeah, wait. No, well, maybe I have a concluding question. Like, we were talking about Die Hard not really being an unexpected Christmas movie anymore because, you know, we know it's a Christmas film. But what would you say is, like, if you could curate somebody's Christmas but make it a bit more left field, you know, a bit more celebrating cinema, what would you, you know, recommend people as, like, an interesting alternative Christmas film?
I think this is not very much an alternative, but and I'm also inspired because you're screening it right now, but I think Singing in the Rain is also an amazing Christmas movie, but that probably already is a Christmas movie, yeah?
Sure.
I wouldn't say Christmas, maybe.
But comfortable,
Elliot
definitely.
Is the expert on Singing in the Rain.
You are?
As he's seen it here with his girlfriend, with nobody in the room but him and his girlfriend.
Wow.
Yeah.
How romantic.
Stop.
That's the power of Tom. Love maker.
Power of love.
Desert power.
Desert power?
I don't know.
Steve.
June.
What would you screen?
Well, I is already screening probably the most left field Christmas movie that you can watch. But I is doing a little retrospective of Béla Tarr, our big Hungarian friend, who makes maybe some of the more miserable films. Like, the films are great, but the people in the films are miserable. But Satan's Tango, even though it's around 7 hours long and is about a group of, like, people being lured into a communal farm and just being totally scammed by this charlatan and everything sucks and it ends up really bad for them. It is, in a strange way, a very Christmassy film. Like, it would be Frank Capra, but then, like, just so much torn apart that it's only kind of like the human suffering that still shines through it. But somehow it's very Christmassy as well. Maybe because you can really hang out in some of those scenes as well. It's also a very beautiful shot. It's very cold. There's some very tender moments in it as well. But those tender moments are also kind of like really opposed by harsh, awful truths about life. So it would be a very, very kind of like great anti-Christmas film, but then still in the Christmas tradition.
I would maybe go Cold War.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one.
I cried. Yeah. The only time I cried during a press screening of a film.
Relate.
Yeah. Tom,
Kiriko can apparently not relate still. she's been gone shooting the eel movie, but it's come back and still no crying.
Yeah, is it called the eel movie and is Jerry Seinfeld poisoning an eel?
Yes, it's called the eel movie. We have now decided that we're going to call it the eel movie. Yeah.
You're welcome.
How about you, Tom? Do you have a final alternative facts Christmas movie?
I don't know. I'm thinking here. Something that's long, something that makes me feel good, something that I've seen thousands of times, something that brings Hugo and me a bit closer together.
You're talking about Heat.
I'm talking about Heat.
Michael Mann film with Al Pacino and Robert De Niro.
Exactly, I'm talking about Heat.
I knew it. I felt it. That's a great Christmas film as well.
There's a flip side to that coin. What if you do got me boxed in? Then I gotta put you down. Because no matter what, you will not get my way. We've been face to face, yeah. But I will not hesitate. Not for a second.
Yeah, I think that's actually, yeah. I don't know, that has this weird, weird stature that everything has all the boxes that it needs to tick for me for Christmas.
Bringing you to closer to me.
yeah, that's one of those boxes.
Well, maybe our audience could also send in some of their favorite unexpected Christmas films. I would be happy to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah,
for sure. And send in your guilty pleasures, I'm sure.
Yeah, your cinema confessions.
Next episode, we're going to be talking about transcendental films. Maybe you'll hear Heat mentioned in that. I'm sure Hugh Hall is going to find a way to bring Michael Mann involved. But we also have a special guest invited by Keely Cole. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit more who we're going to be listening to.
Yeah, for sure. We're inviting Victor van der Valk, who is a fabulous Dutch director.
Yeah,
who,
one of my faves.
Who made a truly stunning film a couple of years ago called Nocturne. And he decided that he would like to talk about transcendental film with us. And Victor really likes to talk about Bresson with us. And therefore...
Yeah, we could maybe pick Auhazar Balthazar as our film for our own little film club. Because it's actually also a great kind of alternative Christmas film, considering it's about donkeys and all.
Good look. And you can find that on Mubi, we believe, right?
Yes, totally. Yes.
So, yes, thanks for listening. Until next time. Thank you.